Questions? There's a hand out there. So we've been doing three-dimensional, multi-dimensional problems. The first ones we did were easy ones where the Hamiltonian split into pieces and then we just had product wave functions. And going on to slightly more complicated ones is where we have no potential. So thinking about this in the context of the bottom of an infinite square well. And what we showed was that the solutions were the spherical Bessel functions, lowercase jl, and the corresponding energy depended upon this value k, h bar squared, k squared over 2m. There were also solutions that were the y, which our book calls n, but those were singular at the origin. So they may come back to haunt us at the end of the semester, but currently we don't need them. If we had negative energy solutions, then we would have these growing and decaying solutions. So if we had a finite square well, where we had part of it was oscillatory and part of it was decaying, we would need those. But the plan isn't to do the plan is only to do the infinite square well. So we only need the JLs currently. So just as with the finite square well, we have to adjust the function that so that it puts a zero where the potential goes to infinity. And so that requires that k times a be a zero of the Bessel functions. And for sine and cosine, the zeros were all well known involving pi's. The zeros of these Bessel functions are not so well known. They are tabulated, for example, in Mathematica. But they're not anything like as regular as they are for sine and cosine. So if you look at your handout for the JLs, you can see that the first zero occurs for L equals 0, and the next zero occurs for L equals 1, and the next zero occurs for L equals 2, and then we get the second zero from L equals 0, then we get the first zero from L equals 3, and so it goes. So we have this root order, and of course the ordering of those roots is then the ordering of the levels, the energy levels. And again, there's not a nice formula for those levels because there isn't a nice formula for the roots. So how did we get there? So this is the process that we did for the simple harmonic oscillator. It's the process that basically if any problem is solvable, it's going to be solvable this way. So first thing you do is you seek dimensionless coordinates, because if you're going to write down a function, it has to be in terms of dimensionless quantities, right? That's the only thing the mathematicians know about. Look at the extremes of the differential equation. When r goes to 0, when r goes to infinity, and typically we're going to factor that behavior out, or at least part of that behavior. So once we've done that, for the remaining nugget, hope that that's a polynomial. And with luck, you get a two-term recursion relationship, something like that. And once you know the secret, you can just read off what the answer is from that two-term recursion relationship. Because this generalized hypergeometric has this recursion relationship. So all you do is look at the polynomial of k that's in the numerator and pick out the a parameters, look at the polynomial in the denominator and pick out the b parameters, and then you've got exactly what this is in terms of a hypergeometric, which probably means nothing to you or most people. But the point is that you can then look up what that hypergeometric is in terms of famous dead physicist names like Bessel. So this hypergeometric provides an index for basically any function that is at all well known. It can be expressed in terms of hypergeometrics. Most common hypergeometrics, the ones we're going to run into this semester, are like F21s, where I've got two parameters up top and one below, F11s, sometimes called confluent hypergeometrics, and F01s, which is in fact what the Bessel functions are. Okay. So this method is tattooable. It's repeatedly always useful. And if I remember correctly, and you should never trust the memory of your professors, I think I was forced to memorize how to solve the hydrogen atom, with a blank sheet of paper by using this sort of approach, which we'll probably start, but probably not finish today. Because before we do that, I want to do another example, and that's the two-dimensional simple harmonic oscillator. So if you look online, we've got all these dimensions, simple harmonic oscillators, square wells, they're all online. They all solve basically the same. So two examples ought to do it. So of course, what we're looking for is solutions to the time independent Hamiltonian, H psi equals E psi. So the eigenfunctions are the psi, the eigenenergies are the corresponding solutions. And the Hamiltonian, we've got kinetic energy, so this is now the two-dimensional Laplacian, derivatives with respect to x squared, derivatives with respect to y squared. We've got the 1/2 kx squared, where I've written the constant k as m omega squared, because that's what it was in 191. And so all of this thing operating on psi is supposed to give me a constant. And this is, of course, separatable in terms of x and y. We've done that. But the plan is instead to go to spherical coordinates. Well, polar coordinates. So that x squared plus y squared is r squared. And if we look up the formula for the Laplacian, what we get is two derivatives with respect to r plus 1 over r derivative with respect to r. And then we get plus two derivatives with respect to phi squared divided by r squared. So of course, the derivatives with respect to phi should remind you of the z component of the angular momentum, right? Because angular momentum in the z direction is h bar over I derivative with respect to phi. And of course, if it's a two-dimensional problem, the only way you can have angular momentum is in the direction that's perpendicular to the plane. So we know the eigenfunctions of this guy are going to be e to the I m phi, where the corresponding eigenvalue is h bar m, right? The I cancels the I in the denominator. It all works great. So of course, if we then write our wave function as some function of r that we're trying to find, and then e to the I m phi, what we're going to get then for our differential equation is minus h bar squared over 2m derivative with respect to r squared plus 1 over r derivative with respect to r. When I bring down two i's from the e to the I phi, I get a minus sign, which is going to cancel that minus sign, so I'm going to get plus h bar squared over 2. Okay, so we have a slight problem that exists here for a second, that we have two m's, right? One of which is the integer m and one of which is the mass of the particle. Then we've got the potential energy. So all of that operating on capital R. It's supposed to give us the energy times R. Say again?
There's two different ones in that.
Yes. Yep, that's what I said. So this one here came from taking derivatives of that guy. So that's the integer, and the other m is the mass of the particle. And we don't want to solve this problem that has all of these constants in it. We want to get to a dimensionless version of this equation. So let me call that constant A. What are the units of that constant? Well, the units of all of this stuff have to be the same thing as the units of energy, since the capital R's are going to cancel out. And we've got two derivatives in the denominator, which are going to give us length scales in the denominator. So the units of this A have to be energy times length squared. Okay, exact same parameter occurs here, so nothing new there. How about this parameter here? Well, again, when multiplied by R squared, I have to get the units of energy. So this guy here, let me call it B, that has to have the units of energy divided by length squared. So I can make a unit of length by taking A and dividing it by B. That'll cancel out the energy term, but it'll give me L to the fourth. So I need to take the fourth root of that to give me something that has the units of energy. And it's going to turn out to be reasonably nice. So this is going to be h bar squared over 2m divided by 1 half m omega squared. All of this to the 1 quarter power. The 2's go away. The m's combine. And this is just the square root of h bar over m omega. Exactly what it was with the simple harmonic oscillator. To make an energy unit, what I need to do is to multiply A times B and then take the square root. So it's going to give me h bar over 2m times 1 half m omega squared, square rooted. So the masses go away. The 2's combine, the omega's combine, so what I get is h bar omega over 2. Again, exactly what we had for the one-dimensional case. So I can write this energy as a dimensionless quantity times the energy unit. And I can write this length as the dimensionless length times the length unit. And I can write these R's that are in the denominator similarly as a the length unit times something that is unitless. So if I do that, what I'm going to get out is minus A, that ugly constant, divided by L squared. And now I get derivatives that are just and quantities that are just respect to the dimensionless quantities. So here we're going to have this factor A divided by L squared, right? Because this is R squared, yep, times M squared. And here we're going to get B times L squared, R prime squared. Okay. So now kind of the magic happens. If we look at what B times L squared is, so that's going to be equal to B times the square root, because that was to the 1 quarter. So this is going to be the square root of B times A. This is exactly the same thing as the energy unit. And similarly, A over L squared, so that's A divided by the square root of A over B. Same story, square root of AB. This thing is exactly equal to the energy unit. So the energy unit cancels out, and now we have a dimensionless equation that doesn't have any of these dimension quantities in it. So it looks like the sort of differential equation that you talked about in diff-EQ, because usually mathematicians don't like things that have units. So we have minus two derivatives with respect to r plus 1 over r, derivative with respect to r, plus the integer m, and then plus r squared. All of this stuff, and I've dropped all of my primes, right? So those r's are all really the dimensionless version of r, and that e is really the dimensionless version of e. And now we have something that there's a great deal more hope of solving. Okay? So seek dimensionless coordinates. There's no hope absent dimensionless coordinates. What can go wrong? Well, you can have problems that have multiple different ways of giving you a length scale. Use one set of parameters, you get one length scale. You use another set of parameters, you get another length scale. What do you do under those circumstances? Well, that means that there's a dimensionless parameter that is the ratio of those length scales. You choose one and you're still going to have the other as part of the problem. This is very common in things like fluid mechanics, and it leads to things like Reynolds number, which is the ratio of two forces, because there are two ways of getting something that has force units. And it makes the problem hugely more difficult to have a parameter, even a dimensionless parameter, but a parameter in it. So we're lucky that all of our problems are not going to be so-called two-scale problems. Okay, check limits. That's the next thing that's on the agenda. How does this thing behave when r goes to zero and when r goes to infinity? Well, when r goes to zero, this becomes hugely small. This becomes moderately small because it's a constant. So everything else has reciprocal powers of r in it, and so it's potentially going to, that has to be the big part of the equation. So if we try out a solution where r goes like r to the a, we can figure out what value of a has some hope of working. So if we do that, got that overall minus sign, this is going to give us an a minus 1. And in the end, everything's going to be times r to the a minus 2. So we can factor that guy out. And here we're going to have an a. And again, we lose two factors of r because one's in the reciprocal and one's taking the derivative. And here we get m squared. Oops, too many unmatched parentheses. So you can see what we're going to get here is minus a squared plus m squared better be equal to zero. So a better equal to m. Now m could be plus or minus, say, 5. Those are different functions, but they have exactly the same value of m squared. So if I want a non-singular function, I want a to be the absolute value of m. And in fact, in everything that follows, I want m to be the absolute value of m. The only place where I want to bother with a negative value of m is when I actually write e to the I m phi. So putting in m equals minus 5 makes a difference for what that function is, whereas putting in m equals minus 5 in this equation makes no difference, so it doesn't matter. But it's bothersome to be writing all of those absolute value signs, so I'm just going to consider in what follows m to be the positive value, and I really should be writing absolute value of m for everything. Okay, So when r goes to 0, r to the absolute value of m, written only that one time, is how that's going to behave. How about when r goes to infinity? Well, this is getting super small. That's not growing. This thing is growing. This thing is getting small. So what we have then is minus two derivatives with respect to r of r is supposed to equal minus, if I put it on the other side, r squared. So that's not a famous differential equation, right? If this were a constant as opposed to r, we'd be all set, but it's not a constant. And what works approximately is e to the plus or minus 1/2 r squared. Because when I take the first derivative of this, I get a r out front. And when I take the derivative here, I get something that I don't particularly want. But when I take the derivative of just this piece, I get another r squared. And if this thing's going to be normalizable, I want it to go to 0. So this thing better be of the form e to the minus 1/2 r squared. Okay, so I hope you think that this has been relatively simple, because what follows is usually the hard part, and that's where we factor out those behaviors. So I'm going to say let's let r equal r to the m, and again it's really absolute value of m, and then e to the minus 1/2 r squared, and then some function, which I'm going to call whatever I called it in my notes. I called it g. I think I called it g. Is there a g here someplace? Yeah, I called it g. So the plan is to take this. So this is rho log. This is without loss of generality. Whatever r is, I can write it in this form, right? Because g is just r divided by this stuff. So the plan is to take this and plug it into this differential equation and get a differential equation for g as opposed to r. And I wish I could tell you that that differential equation for g looks better than this one. I don't. To me, it looks about the same. It's hard to see how I've improved anything. But the improvement I've got is that it will turn out that if I want something like a polynomial, it's guaranteed, you know, any polynomial, when you put in r goes to infinity, it's going to go to infinity, right? It's going to have some highest power of r in it, and that's going to dominate in the end. So if I had just plugged in for capital R as a polynomial, it can't work. But now I factored out this term, which is going to force it to go to 0 at infinity. And I factored out this term here, which is going to force g to be 1 at r equals 0. So in between those two, g could be a polynomial and still satisfy all of the conditions. Okay, and it is, in some sense, a vain hope that this works, right? If we don't get a two-term recursion relationship in the end, we're screwed. But, you know, no surprise, since this is the only thing that works, it'll work 100% of the time in the textbook problems. It won't work 100% of the time in real life. But it's kind of the only thing you can do. Okay, so off to the races. So I need r prime, and I'm going to do this in, I don't know, maybe a clever way. What happens here is the m comes down and I reduce the power of r by 1, and I can write that as m over r times capital R. When I take the derivative of this term, we know what happens is I get a a minus R that comes down. So that's what I get from taking the derivative of the first two terms. And what's left over is R to the M e to the minus 1 half R squared times G prime. So what I gain from this is that when I take the second derivative of this, I can just recopy what I have for R prime at this point, as opposed to redoing all of those terms. So it's a slight shortcut. There's another slight shortcut that comes from the realization that I can rewrite this quantity in the following way. I can write this as 1 over R derivative with respect to R of R derivative with respect to R of R. And we can check that out, that that's true. So this is equal to 1 over R R R prime primed. So that's equal to 1 over R. When I take the prime of this, I get R prime plus R R double prime. And when I bring through the 1 over R, I get exactly that quantity. So what I'm going to do then is look at what happens when I get multiply my R prime by R. So I get M minus R squared R plus R to the M plus 1 e to the minus 1 half R squared G prime. And now I want to take the derivative of that. So the derivative of this, moderately easy. The derivative of R prime of R itself, there it is. So it's equal to M over R minus R times R plus R to the M e to the minus 1 half R squared G prime. Now I've got to take derivatives of this guy, and I think I save a little bit of time by doing kind of the same trick. So this is equal to m plus 1 over r minus r all times r to the m plus 1 e to the minus 1 half r squared g prime. That's where the derivative hits those terms. And finally, the double prime term. Okay, so finally I need to take 1 over R of all of this. All right, all of this is just to calculate this piece here. I still have all of those other pieces that need to go along for the ride. Okay. And let's maybe write it in reverse order. Well, write it reverse order, non-reverse order. I don't know. Maybe we'll keep things in the same order. So here we're going to have minus 2 times R from this term. And here we're going to have M over R minus R, M over R minus R times R. That's that term. And then we're going to have M over R minus R, R to the M e to the minus 1 half R squared G prime from the next term. Here, I'm going to have something similar, except I'm going to take my R out of this term there. And finally, I've got the double prime term. Okay, so what have we got? Well, it's not quite as bad as it looks. If I look at what this term here is, I'm going to have a m squared over r squared, and that's going to be all set up to cancel that term there. And I'm going to have a plus r squared term, that's all set up to cancel that guy there. So it's really only the cross terms I care about, and the cross terms are fairly simple, right? It's just going to give us a minus 2m. And after we do that cancellation. Okay, so with that in mind, let's take our differential equation and let's plug in this for that derivative stuff. So here I have a minus 2 that is minus, so it's plus 2. And let me bring it over to this side of the equation so I get a e minus 2. And also I can set this all up now so I can divide out all of this common factor. So I just have g left on that side. We've seen that what I get here after I do this cancellation is just minus 2m, but there's an overall minus sign, so this is equal to 2m. G is all that's left. And then I've got my g prime terms. Okay, so again, this factor is going to cancel out. What do I have for the remainder? Well, these two terms are the same, and those two terms are the same. So what I'm going to end up with is minus again, because this whole thing is minus. So I'm going to end up with minus 2m plus 1 over r. That's these two terms combined, and then minus 2r. And then finally, I've got minus g double prime. Okay, so there's some chance that I did this correctly. This looks good. Let me just kind of rewrite this a little bit. So this is minus g double prime minus 2m plus 1 over r minus 2r times g prime plus 2m plus 1 minus e g equals 0. Okay, so that's the hard part. Rewriting your differential equation in terms of g as opposed to what you started with. And what we gain is something that we can solve. That is to say, if I were to plug in a polynomial for r in the original differential equation, I would not get a two-term recursion relationship and I could not solve it. This guy will have a two-term recursion relationship, and I can then immediately solve that with hypergeometrics. And then I'm good. Okay, so how do we plug in our polynomial? So the plan is we're hoping that g is equal to the summation of some coefficients with powers of k. We try a polynomial solution. And the hope is that we then get a two-term recursion relationship for those coefficients ak. Okay, so off to the races. So if I take two derivatives of g, I'm going to bring down a k and a k minus 1, and all of this is going to be times ak r to the k minus 2. So for the second term, And actually let me do these, break apart these two terms. So for this term here, I'm going to get minus 2m plus 1, a k is going to come down from taking the derivative, and I'm going to get r to the k minus 2 because of this r that's in the denominator. For the next term, which is now plus, the derivative and this r are going to cancel, so what I'm going to get is plus 2 k times ak, r to the k. And of course, for the rest of it, it's just going to go along for the ride. And of course, this is really summed over k. So it's not immediately obvious how this can be zero, because this power of r doesn't match this power of r. So if I look two terms ahead in my polynomial and do this process to it, I will get r to the k at the end of this. So what I really want to look at is the term that is two ahead of where I am. So let's take a look at what that term is. Let's just let k go to k plus 2. So this is going to be minus k plus 2, k plus 1, ak plus 2. And now I get r to the k minus 2m plus 1, k plus 2, r to the k. And everything else is already in this form. So the coefficient of r to the k has to be 0. So all of those things have to be 0. And I now have a two-term recursion relationship for ak. So what we go is a0 is going to tell us what a2 is, and a2 is going to tell us what a4 is, and onward it goes. So there aren't going to be any odd terms in this, which kind of makes sense because we factored out the whole r to the m to start with. Well, we can make this look a little bit nicer. If I combine these two terms, right, they have a common factor. So this is going to be k plus 2 times 2m plus 1, well, plus 2 from these two guys, plus k. And I guess it won't hurt to combine these two factors. So what I'm going to have here is 2m plus 1 minus e plus 2k, ak. And if I just put these things together, what I get then is that, what do I want to erase? This is mostly done now. So what I've got then is all of that stuff, 2m plus 1 minus e plus 2k ak. And I can put all of that negative stuff on the other side to give me ak plus 2 and divide the other stuff through. And what we had was, this was a 2, I guess, 2m plus 2 plus k. Okay, so there is a slight fly in the ointment, namely here, we had every coefficient, whereas now we have every other coefficient. So I want to get rid of all of those terms that are zero, all of the odd terms, and just think about k as being an even number. So it's equal to 2 times I. Okay, so if I do that, the previous term is equal to the new term. And what I've got then here is 2 m plus 1 minus e plus 4i divided by 2i plus 2, 2m plus 2 plus 2i. Okay, now there's one other thing I need to do in order to just read off the coefficient of k, which is I over here, has to be 1, right? So I can't have this 4 if I want to just read these things off. So I actually have to reduce this. Notice that those 2's are going to cancel. So if I divide everything by 4, what I'm going to have is m plus 1 over 2 minus e over 4 plus I divided by I plus 1 and m plus 1 plus I. Okay, so that coefficient tells us what that guy is. And this coefficient tells us what that guy is. So the solution is a F11 of m plus 1 divided by 2 minus e over 4. And then for the bottom coefficient, we have m plus 1. And all of this depends on r squared, right? Because we're going up by double powers. Okay, looking like I didn't make any mistakes. So now comes kind of important trick. We want to get polynomials out of this, finite polynomials. So how could it be that this sum would terminate? And if you think about it, it will terminate if one of these factors is minus an integer. Because as I start building up on that minus integer, I'll reach 0. And once I reach 0, everything is 0 from there on out. Does that make sense? The shifted factorial goes up. And if it's going up from a negative integer, it's guaranteed to hit 0. Once it hits 0, it's all over. So this quantity here has to be a negative integer. And I'm going to call this, n is, I guess, as good a name as any. So what I have then is that m plus 1 over 2 minus the energy divided by 4 has to be a negative integer. So if I rearrange this a little bit, this is m plus 1 over 2 plus n has to be the energy divided by 4. So the energy has to be 2n plus m plus 1. Well, we already know what the energy is, right? Because it splits into two harmonic oscillators. So it should be 2nx plus ny plus 2. Oops, plus 1, right? 2 overall, but so the smallest energy I can get, I can put both of these guys to be 0, and I get 2. And the best I can do here is to put both of these guys equal to 0, and I get 2. The next thing I can do is to put one of these to be 1 and the other one to be 0, in which case I get 4. And I can do the same thing by having this be 0 and this be 1, and I get 4. Notice that there are two ways of doing this, right? I could have this be 1, 0, or 0, 1. And there are two ways of making that same energy here, because remember, this is really absolute value of m. So I can put m equals plus 1 or minus 1.
If you have m equals 0 and n equals 1, then that'd be 6.
If I put, So I'm going to put this n be 0,
oh, okay,
and this be 1, so I get 4. So the kind of next step up I could make is I could put both of these guys be 1. And there's only one way of doing that. And that's going to give me 6. And if I'm going to get 6, then I need to have 3 on the inside. And that means that this n has to be 1 and this m has to be 0. And there's no way of having plus minus 0, right? So that there's just one state. And we could go up through the lines, but this is actually giving us the same set of energies that we got the other way. So why bother? Well, it's nice to have things that show the symmetry of the problem, right? If the problem is azimuthally symmetric, it's nice that solutions are azimuthally symmetric as opposed to being square symmetric, the way the XY solutions were. But they have to be exactly the same solutions, right? Because it's the same differential equation. So it must be that I can take these round solutions and write these square solutions if I really wanted to, as linear combinations of them. And you'll be doing that for homework, I think. Questions? Okay, so you have a handout on the H atom. And let's at least get to the dimensionless units. And maybe I won't do quite so much algebra on the board when we actually go ahead and do this. So the potential energy of an electron to a nucleus that has a positive charge of ZE, the formula for potential energy was the product of the charges divided by 4 pi epsilon naught r. So we're going to have a potential energy that is minus ze squared over 4 pi epsilon naught r. And no way I'm ever going to write the combination again. So I'm just going to call all of that alpha. And so our differential equation is going to be minus h bar squared over 2m. And then we have this Laplacian stuff, which was two derivatives with respect to r plus 2 over r, one derivative with respect to r. That's the angular part. And then we had the centrifugal potential. And here I'm already writing the wave function as being an r times one of these ylms. So that's why I already have replaced my angular momentum operator by its eigenvalue. And then I've got this potential energy, which is minus alpha over r. And all of this wants to equal the energy times r. So what are the units of these things? Well, nothing has changed about this h bar squared over 2m. It has to have the units of energy times length squared. Alpha over r has to have the units of energy, so this has to be an energy times a length. So I can make a length unit by taking, let me call this thing capital A like I did before, by taking capital A and dividing it by alpha. And I can make an energy unit by taking alpha squared and then dividing it by A. You see that those things work? Now, Yes, okay. I did it a different way, but it's the same story. So one thing that's a little bit new is for historical reasons, we're going to choose our length unit to be exactly equal to that. And then this thing turns out to be a famous dead physicist. This turns out to be the Bohr radius. And it's about half an angstrom for the hydrogen atom. And if I change my length unit here, the energy unit changes a little bit, and it's now a famous dead physicist, Hartree. And for the hydrogen atom, it turns out to be about 27.2 electron volts. Okay. So if we do, you know, exactly this same process, we end up with this black equation that's about halfway through that doesn't have any dimensionless units in it. It doesn't have any variables in it. So you might notice that we've done something that's a little bit funny. The one half that sits out front of those derivatives, we've brought all of that out front so that we have 2 over R and 2 times E. And the other thing that you want to keep in mind is we're looking for bound state energies. So that energy we're thinking is going to be negative. And usually when you see a constant sitting there, you think about it as being positive. So it helps thinking to always be writing minus absolute value of E to remind yourself that energy is in fact negative. If we look at the behavior as R goes to infinity, the centrifugal potential is small, the electrostatic energy is small, so the derivative term has to match the energy term. And that's going to lead to exponential decay, just like it has in the past. And here we get this other sleight of hand. I'm going to define my rho variable to be this square root of 8 absolute value of energy times R. Why bother? Well, the first reason to do that is it gets rid of energy from the equation. And energy is always a little bit confusing because it's negative. And you can get tired of writing absolute values of E. And the other reason to do it is it works, I guess, is kind of the bottom line. Okay, so once I define my rho, I now have a differential equation to solve. And so this thing is going to exponentially decay for large values of rho. Why is that? Well, if we think about what the effective potential looks like, it's 1 over R, but then we have this centrifugal potential. And if we're looking at a bound state, we've got a state like that. So we've got 2 classical turning points. So we're expecting that the wave function decay where it has negative kinetic energy, and it should be decaying in this region, and it should be oscillating between those 2 turning points. And when we look at how the behavior has to go near R equals 0, it turns out it has to go like rho to the L. And we've seen that formula lots of times, right? So last semester in E&M, things went like R to the L times solutions to the angular momentum, which were then called Legendre polynomials. So here we have that same behavior of rho to the L. So what's left is the hard part, right? To factor out all of that stuff and rewrite the differential equation. Yuck, right? There are all the steps. Various cancellations. In the end, we get a differential equation that doesn't seem much improved over the original differential equation, but, you know, there's gold in them, there hills. This one is solvable. Plug in, crank it out, and we get a hypergeometric. And we can look up for the name of that hypergeometric, and it turns out Laguerre. I don't know anything about Laguerre, so I guess I assume he was a mathematician. His polynomials. I also give you the following quick warning. The exact normalization of these polynomials does vary a little bit from book to book. And I think there's a footnote in Griffiths that says he knows that and he thinks he's written these things in the usual form. And I would say he hasn't. I would say he's chosen unusual forms, and the upshot of, and the way I've chosen it is the way Mathematica chose it, so that's kind of the only important thing to choose. There's a standard reference called Abramowitz, and Abramowitz and I agree, and we disagree with Griffiths. So the upshot is be a little bit careful when you see formulas that involve things that are as obscure as an associated Laguerre polynomial. They really are defined differently. Legendre polynomials are all the same. But as you move away from Legendre, and Hermite polynomials are all the same, as far as I've ever seen. But as you start moving away from those standard cases, things, people choose different normalizations for different reasons. And Griffiths is one of them.